That's it. Whoa. That's you guys, right? Not me. I have to say it again. Welcome to the second day of presentations for the Mac Fockers 2007. I didn't do PowerPoint, so I'm your PowerPoint, so I'm going to have to do something. I'll probably walk a little bit just to give you something to follow along. It's exciting and anxiety producing to do a presentation about what I've been doing for the last almost 2 years, because I think I'm so in it that it's very hard to step out of it and then get an overview of what you're doing, and then another overview about having a meta position of process work in your own day-to-day work. So it's taken a few challenges to back up and back up and back up and look at what you've got in front of you. And that's what I feel like I do every day with the families that I work with. For the last, little less than 2 years, and I know you all know that because I've done some of that work with you and in class, I've worked with families in crisis. And by definition, families in crisis means families that have come to the attention of the Department of Family and Child Services. Now, most counties or states have a number of these state departments that are responsible for assessing the safety and the needs of families in the community. So people get to the department in one of a few different ways, but either they come because a family is looking for help, and a family member, it could be a parent, it could be a child, it could be a teen, calls them up and says, we're having a problem. Or somebody on the outside looks at a family and says, this family needs help, and no one's paying enough attention to them. And that could be a school, it could be the police, it could be juvenile justice centers, any kind of outside social service. So just by that alone, you can see that there's more eyes and ears that are needed to help maintain safety generally in a family. So my role then is I come in as an independently contracted family therapist. I am neither employed directly by the state, but I sign contracts with the department. So I'm a liaison for the department to go in and follow their guidelines on what they want accomplished within a home. But if I take another step back and see myself as a process worker outside of even that role, I look at myself more as a field worker, somebody that is aware of that state agency, all the other social services or state agencies that have been involved with that family and called in, and in effect are serving as roles, missing roles in the family. If I'm able to, again, like I said, step out and see myself, then I can have a larger awareness and pick up a lot of signals and information before I even walk into the family's home. What do I want to say about that? A couple of things. One thing is that from the State Department, back in 1977, legislature has written, it's defined, as defined by the 1977 Juvenile Justice Act, legislature declared that the family is the fundamental resource of American life, which should be nurtured and remain intact in absence of compelling evidence to the contrary. So already the state has an agenda, which is to help a family stay intact. Behind that are other issues, because intact means that the children, all the way up to age 18, remain with their parents until age 18. One of the side supporting reasons for that is if a child is unwanted in the home by the parents, or the teen doesn't want to be in the home because of, whatever, conflicts and things, the state is at risk of having to pay for foster care to then house that child. They don't want to do that. So our services are more affordable to have someone come in and work for either 6 months to six weeks to 6 months to help resolve or support a transition at that point, which may be that child living out of the home, but it also might be exhausting other resources where a child could go if they can't stay in the home. Most of my families are teens, so somewhere between 13 and 18, although I also have families that are children's range. I would say I've probably worked with somewhere between 60 and 70 families in the last couple of years, which it kind of gives me, at least at this point, an overview of how processes work in families, which is interesting to note. One more thing I want to say, by the time I get involved with a family, I guess I should say something personal about it. One of the things that's exciting for me about this job, I never thought I would be in family therapy, but it's a boot camp and a training ground for conflicts outside of the home for all the larger issues, because these families in particular are a hotbed of recycled and marginalized problems. Oftentimes, all the outside referral and support systems and things that have come in have only embedded some of the underlying issues, because people in general have to function at some sort of linear manner. And if I go in with a different view and can support something dreaming or nonlinear, that takes things in an unknown or a different direction, possibly. And so from that perspective, it helps things go in a different direction. Maybe it's kind of unknown. What I want to say about that, too, is in my paper, the goal of my paper was specifically to look at some of the nonlinear interventions and aspects of process work. That could be non-local, being aware of a non-local aspect of the field, of parallel worlds. Let me think. It could also be dream doors, finding dream doors in a family and how to use them. Okay. Yeah. I might sit down here.
What you said, there's you encounter patterns of sort of marginalized material, but you didn't give examples. I'd love to just know, like, one or two, what that might be, or are you going to go into that?
Good. I think, and if I don't answer it, I'll come back to it, but I think that some of the examples that I use, I'll get more specific. That was sort of the overview. I think exactly what I'm looking at and that I'm learning from, you know, all the time. Am I going too fast or too slow? You can give me feedback about that. Great. I'm going to slow down a little because I just had to get the first little paragraph out in my head. Okay, so how do I do it, basically, is I think what you're asking. What am I looking for? One of the things that's been really helpful, and it's taken a time to just learn to trust it, and I'm still learning, you know, to trust it. When I get a phone call and a referral is made and I'm requested, or they're just looking for someone to work with a family, important to then call back to the social worker. I don't get the referral. My office manager gets the referral initially, and they usually call me and give me the information. But I call back to the social worker, and I ask them what their hit was about this family, what their experience was with the family, what stood out to them. This is amazing. This is like sitting in a counseling session, and if you were to videotape the first 5 minutes of your session and not do anything else but study the first 5 minutes, you are often able to pick up the dynamics of the whole situation and work with that. And if I, you know, when I'm able to do that, it's been very helpful, and I can give you some examples. I had one family one time where the social worker talked to me about the size of the family. He said it's a very violent family. He said the funny thing was that when he looked at the four family members, and they were all biological, there was the mom, a dad, and a son, and they were, he said, huge, like just big people, very tall, big, kind of like bears. And then there was a young girl who was in her early teens, and she was the slightest, most daintiest looking creature. And the issue was that the three, mother, father, and brother, or son, would get into physical fights, roll around on the floor, you know, have these incredible, you know, attacks upon each other until the police came, or until the daughter would sometimes call the police. Okay. So I said, interesting that, you know, out of all the different things that he tells me about, he gives me a very clear picture about their size. So in the background, I started thinking, size, power, unknown power, split off power. I started thinking about spiritual power. I started thinking about rank issues, like all the places that people have power that they may not be aware of. And that one of my jobs in there, I mean, the caseworker says, one, I want you to basically stop the violence, you know? So aside from like getting people off each other, you know, was working with them to pick up their power. It's funny, I want to tell you, I'll come back to this family maybe a few times, but it's funny, the one thing, I went in and I played a game with them. It was like just after Christmas, and there was like a little, it's kind of like a magic eight ball, but it wasn't. It had more words on it where you just shake it up and then a word comes up. And I think the word was psychic. I remember they told me how to play it, and I played it once, and it came up psychic. And it was the first session I had, and I said, this is going to be very relevant, and I'll work together. I'm not sure how. And I was a little afraid they'd think I was crazy. And, you know, so there's a lot of, you know, you feel that, the experience, you know, you feel the field. You know, you're just like, what will I get away with? I don't know what to say about that now, just that, you know, we did end up working with that, with their power, and, you know, basically some of the things was helping, the son had voices, very strong voices, which told him to kill himself. So I'd never got to work with him specifically so much on those pieces, but just the depth of their sensitivity and their like intuitiveness was very strong. What I did then eventually work with was the role of a dead grandmother that the mother would bring in or talk about, and the whole family had such a strong relationship to the dead grandmother. And when we worked with the dead grandmother, it was like her capacity to hold the family together, and her connective abilities. And what we then on the consensus reality world worked on was the mother getting a new job. She was very unhappy in her role, bloody, bloody, blah, but you can see where the power issues come out again. Something about their intuitiveness, their psychicness, the ability to really, they did role plays with me a bit, and to work with dead grandmothers and things like that. I mean, they were open to this kind of thing, and so again, there was more evidence of these different powers, and then just power in the world. And the son had a whole process around dropping out of school and getting his GED, which he excelled in, and then having to now step out into the world, which is one of the main edges in process work, which Arnie defines. It's picking up your power in the world. So those were all the edges that we worked with in the family. But again, coming back to those first 5 minutes, those dynamics were evident to a degree. You just don't know in which ways they'll flesh out. So my learning in this is partly to see if I can get a sense of that beforehand, and that may give me a little confidence, because when you walk into a family, you just never know what's going to happen, where people are at, and what their processes will be. Okay. So that's a little segue to roles in the field. Interesting. Let me hang on here. Let me just catch up with myself. Oh, I wanted to talk about a little bit about the different scenarios that you get when you walk into a family. Like, and it's sort of working with the primary identity of a family, where some families you walk in and they're ready to shoot each other. I walked in with one family and the mother said, "Good, you're here, we're having a fight. Get in here now." As if we didn't even have an appointment. She didn't know I was coming. It was just, "Oh, by the way, I just happened to show up, and well, good that you're here because we're going to kill each other," you know? So you knew your job at that point was all the amazing world work skills we are taught, which is, and it's hard to do in the moment. You know, it's hard when, you know, people are just yelling at each other, and then there's an issue that you have to either side with one way or the other, and you're thinking, how do I just get through this, you know? But again, you know, they call it in the family therapy field damage control, meaning like how many fires can you put out? You know, will you even get to the deeper issues where you get to some therapy, like more longer term therapeutic work, is sometimes a question. A lot of times you might be in families that are just so chaotic, so many historical issues that you are just putting out fires, damage control. I call that world work in a way. I call that working with de-escalation a lot, working with hot spots, working with, a lot of times it's mediation, meaning you're working on the level of communication skills. Oh, you looked upset. Can you say something about your feeling? You're yelling. Maybe you don't feel heard. You look nervous. Now, that's hard to do. And, well, what I want to say, why is it hard? Because if I am particularly one of the people being scared or knocked out or feeling unconscious in the moment, you know, then it's just kind of hanging in there. And sometimes I just hang in there until that time is up. I get out of there and then I go, what was I in? And I'm realizing more and more that it's the fields you walk into are incredibly powerful. And many, many times I have to do a lot of inner work on myself before I get there, just knowing that a certain family member is going to knock me out if I'm in there more than a few minutes without intervening with that field. I could say, do you want to hear more examples about that? Okay. Because I have a few. Hang on. I'm thinking of two particularly. Okay. Yeah, these are good examples. One is the family that you know, that you've seen. It was a mom and a daughter. So I'll talk about my inner process with them. This goes back again to the referring social worker. And just what she told me made me nervous. So I know if I'm nervous, then I'm already at an edge, you know, in myself. She said, this mom is very strong, direct, challenging, and she wants somebody strong to work with. I thought, don't ask me. It's not me. And she said, no, it's you. Just be really direct with her. But I remember like the first, I think it was like 2 days, I remember setting up the appointment, it was on Friday, and I think for 2 to 3 days I had to work on myself, knowing that I get knocked out by sometimes very critical female figures. And what did I want to say about that? This was it, this was the point. That now looking back on it, I could see how my reaction to criticism was one extreme or the other. Either I would feel defeated and criticized, get hurt, take it personally, and not be able to basically do my job very well or keep much awareness. On the other hand of that, I was afraid of just reacting strongly and being defensive. And that's less likely what I would do. But given those two choices, I was likely to either bounce to one or the other. What wasn't in my grasp with this, that mother, was just being detached and seeing the whole as a outside of myself and having the freedom to work with these dynamics. Well, you're really strong. Well, you just criticized me. Oh, look at that. Golly gee, you know? But what I got, and it took me about a year to get, no, 6 months now since I've worked with the family to get, is that was the mother's edge. That was actually the mother's edge. She, yeah. What do you mean?
Well, she was so defensive here.
Yeah. Yep. And on a smaller scale, like I wasn't likely to smack her, you know. It was a much smaller scale, but it was the same dynamic, right? And that's what the mom was working on. Which looked different because both her and her family had grown up in very violent situations. So her likelihood was somebody attacks her, she slugs them, or she gets very aggressive, or puts them down until they can't function. So, you know, we had a little, like, I think, underground martial arts section session where we were checking each other out, and, you know, and here I was trying to teach her the thing that I was learning in the moment. Just to follow up with that, I recently was asked to work with that family again. I think I can say this, and the mom is different. She's a different person. It's pretty amazing. She actually, at a small escalation in conflict, she called up the social worker and said, "It's not as bad as it was, but it's getting bad, and I want to deal with it now." I mean, how much better can you get for preventative de-escalation techniques? We had a meeting. I came in before I was even, you know, before the referral even started, just to meet with them. She hugged the social worker. I mean, she was much more. It was amazing. Amazing to see after, and you kind of, you know, a little bit about that family. So amazing stuff. Do you want one more example, or when we move? Okay, one more example. I mean, you guys are nodding. I don't know where everybody else is. Okay, keep going. Okay. Speak. Okay, it's because it's short. It's a grandfather, and it's kind of a curmudgeonly or kind of a stiff grandfather. And when I go in, my job is to work with the family. Well, he's really, this is not about me. This is about my grandson that I've raised, and look at how bad he is, and, you know, look at all that he's done. And then when the kid walks by, the grandfather, what? The grandfather, you know, makes a snide comment to the kid, who of course then reacts in all kinds of extreme and flourishing, you know, ways. See him swear at me, and I'm like, what did you just? You just called him, you know, an idiot. You know, I'm like, he's not going to send you, you know, kisses and flowers on that one. But this grandfather, he just was so, you know, strong in his defensiveness around that, and he wants to tell stories like many people in their 70s are likely to do. So he'd tell me stories about what a good guy he is, essentially. And I realized that he needed support. But on one hand, in my own feeling skills, I wasn't 100% on his side. I knew that he wanted to be seen as a good guy. He wanted to be given credit as a grandfather who raised his grandson from the time he was 4, which is a big job to do. Not many grandparents want to step into that role, and he was there. And it took me a little while to get myself on his side. And I would say nice things to him, but they weren't even convincing to me. So I was like, it's not going to fly as if it was a full intervention. So I think, what was I answering? I was answering something about my role in the field. Oh, and I realized that the fact that I wanted to confront the grandfather, at least to get to them to the point of seeing where he may contribute to conflicts in the home, was the exact same edge that the grandson was at, and why the grandson was always trying to start fights whenever he had the chance, because he wanted his grandfather to acknowledge that he does things to start fights, and that he wasn't always a good guy. And my last meeting with him before my break here was with the grandfather, and I really got on his side, and I was really supporting him, and I said something to him, and he said, "Well, because I believe I'm always right." And then he cracked up, which I thought, alone, without me having to drill it into his head, you know, and be the bad guy and beat him up, he laughed at himself. And I thought, okay, drop. You know, we started something here. And I've been saying it to him all along, but I think unconvincingly, because it just felt critical. But in this way, I laughed with him, and then I said, "That's what I like about you so much. I said that you're always, you know," something. I made it a little sarcastic, but it was in a good-natured way. So anyway, this is what, in part, what I'm learning is how my feeling experiences in these different fields, you know, you hear it, we hear it, we try to apply it, but it takes like 1,000 times over to start to trust it, and I'm only beginning now 70 families later or whatever, to get a sense of what that feels like and how that may be useful in the role in the family. And I think the other essential thing is then finding help when I'm at an edge that I feel like, oh my gosh, I walk into this family and I feel either like a kid or I feel like I'm stupid or whatever, is to find a friend to talk to about it so that you can get an overview, because they're, you know, friends are always easier at seeing things than you are often. Okay. I'm going to skip that for a minute. I want it, I guess, because I kind of talked about that. Okay. I think then this is a good segue for meta skills, basically feeling aspects, feeling attitudes. My paper, again, talks about the meta skill a lot. In the history of family therapy, it's a very interesting story. Back in the day, back in the early 1945 was initially when systems theory was developed, and then family therapy was one area of study that adopted systems theory, looked at a family as a whole, as a system, and how each of those members and their interactions together created something rather than just the individual. So they had that the identified patient. They acknowledged was not all about the patient. It was about the dynamics in the family that contributed to this person holding that role. They didn't use those words, but holding that experience. So really phenomenal stuff happening. But one person that I talk about specifically is Virginia Satir, which some of you know very well. She was she was the mother of family therapy. She was in the early 1950s, the only woman and social worker in a field of primarily white male psychiatrists. And one of her big, aspects of her work was her feeling nature. She was very caring. She was very nurturing. She also, I think, picked up a role of being a mother, which is needed in so many of the families that you look at. Like, what's missing? Somebody that has a big spirit, you could say an elder, you know, that is able to love everybody. And I think she really carried that role for a while, or did that in her family work just authentically. Interesting story, though, is that maybe it was closer to the early mid-1970s, so maybe 15 years into her work, and she was the head of the Research Institute. She was a director of training there. She was a director of training at Esalen. But so she had definitely established herself, but she actually split with some of the other founding family therapy people. Mnuchin is one, who was a structuralist, who basically criticized her for having an evangelical approach and telling her that love cannot solve family problems alone. It takes more than that. So for me, I look back at that and I think it was marginalized in that field a lot, was those feeling skills and essences. And I think that process work now takes that further by being able to name it, and then being able, the brilliance of it is being able to make use of it so strongly through that facilitator or person with awareness. It could be anybody in the family, but basically the person at the moment who has the awareness and can bring it back in a useful way. Phenomenal. I didn't even tell you the name of my thesis topic is The Facilitator and the Shaman, an Exploration of Process Work Interventions in Family Therapy. So that, again, is where that comes in, I think, is kind of having a focus on the facilitator and those shamanistic aspects which make this work really stand out in a pretty phenomenal way. It makes it kind of magical. What do I want to say? Okay, I guess I'll just jump. I have a lot of different examples, but I want to talk about one story particularly that I thought was very powerful. And again, it's like these don't come along every day. So when you get to the point where the timing's right and you've got the courage and the family's, you know, there or whatever, however those things align, that you can bring in, I think, some strong interventions and maybe like with skill, it gets, you know, you see more opportunity to do that or you make that space. I want to talk about how those meta skills actually really helped with a family. I'm trying to be generic as well about the identities of the family, just so, I mean, I know you don't know them, but just to kind of protect. So there was a mom, her husband, and a daughter, probably 14 or so, 14, 15, 15 to 16. And, just interesting story. I'm just trying to put it all together. Maybe I'll start with the referral. She didn't like counselors. We'll start there. The daughter. And here's why. The thing that kind of led to me being there was she had been having more and more conflicts with her mom. They started to get a little violent, like they would push each other. The daughter didn't want to go to a counseling session, so then it escalated. The mother tried to fight with the daughter to get her to go, physically forced her, you know, like not a good scene, right? You will work on yourself, I'll make you. So they got into a fight. The mother locked the daughter out of the house. The police were called. The police came. I think either she went into a psychiatric institute after that and then eventually went into foster care. I mean, like over a counseling session. I mean, yes, the issues had been escalating anyway, and there was a lot of, there's something else going on, right? I thought, ooh, I was not looking forward to meeting, you know, this girl. I was like, she's going to throw things at me. So working with her, she was a very quiet girl, pretty nonverbal. And the whole first session was basically me, like, trying to engage her and through her hair, you know, and non-speaking. It was, you know, it was a lot of hits, a lot of misses, you know. But the one thing that she agreed to work with me on was her relationship with her mother. I thought, okay, you know, as long as mom's here, we've got some work to do. What had come out in the recent past was that over the years, she was being sexually molested by a stepbrother when he would come to visit, and it happened over a period of time, and she hadn't told anybody. And then it eventually came out in like, she had two psychiatric hospitalizations. So there you go. It's all getting pathologized. She's being identified as crazy. I mean, she's a young girl. It's just, like, overbearing. And it's funny, I feel it now, and I felt it in the family, and how hard it was for that girl to say anything, to the point that, you know, the mother didn't really believe her either. The mom didn't have convincing evidence, you know, and whether it was just not wanting to believe that had happened to her daughter, or, you know, whatever the reasons were. And that was one of the main concerns with the referral was, we have a mom that's not really backing her daughter, right? So, you know, initially going in there, it was helpful. It was so helpful to hear that social worker because I knew my role at that time. And in some ways, it was to be a protector. It was to protect the daughter. It was to kind of protect the daughter from the mother's disbelief, which was painful. And then what I found in the second or so session was that there was a younger child that was going to go stay with the family for the summer, was then to protect him because the potential abuse and harm and, you know, and so really was focusing that mom to pick up that role of protector, which she did. I have to give her lots of credit that I, you know, we stuck it to her in a few ways, you know, just that here's your options. Let's figure out where your child's going to be, who's going to be with them, you know, and she really did. And because of the other behaviors of this stepson, you know, he was having a lot of problems in a lot of places. It helped her to become more concerned and pick up that role more. But what I want to come back to in terms of the meta skills. So there you go. You've got, you know, a protector role that's missing. You've got a mom that comes in and is able to pick that up a little bit. Helpful, really helpful. But in the background, there's still this very heavy feeling that the daughter is never able to fully express. She actually dissociates a lot. We've got a nonverbal, you know, person anyway. And so her and I do some individual stuff in movement. We're working on picking up her power. She talks to me about how she likes to have fights with her male friends at school. We have fights, you know, in her house and, you know, physical fights. You know, not fights, but, you know, movement processes, and she has a lot of fun with that. One day, and there was a stepfather who was like a second stepfather. And this is interesting because I felt like he never really knew where to belong in the family. And it's interesting because her biological, the girl's biological dad, she didn't know. The stepfather basically had raised her, that was father of the abusive stepbrother. But then he cut her off once she'd been to a psychiatric hospital and said, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And then we have another stepfather, right? And when I first came to the home, the stepfather jumped in. He said, do you need me here? And he was kind of anxious, and I didn't really know what was going on with him. But he was like, well, my mother's a psychotherapist. I really don't believe in therapy. I said, how do you deal with conflict? He says, I don't really have any. I said, well, good, then we don't need you. I said, I'll let you know if we do, you know. I thought we can bring him in later. Interestingly enough, he shows up maybe halfway through, maybe a little more than halfway through, and jumps in and says, can I be involved in one of your sessions with the family? I was like, sure. And so he sits down, and there's girl who's quiet anyway with me. She's, you know, we're not going to, like, work on this stuff overtly. And there's mom, and there's stepdad. So I just started to talk. I started to talk about the feeling of what it might be like to be a victim or to be in a role that you can't talk about the feelings that you're having. And I said, you know, a 13 or 14-year-old can't express those feelings. I said most 40-year-olds aren't able to talk about the depth of the crisis in the background. And I said, and they had been, you know, there had been things where the daughter was very quiet, but then she would blow up or she'd throw something and, you know, like dent the furniture, or, you know, like damage something. And so they were like, fix her, you know, like, can you make this better? You know, and you're like, well, maybe, you know, we'll see. So I started talking. I said, so here's some things that go on in the background. And I was very moved by it because I could feel it. And I feel it now a little bit. It was, there's questions in the background, like, you know, do you blame me? Do you think differently of me? Do you think it's my fault? Do you, I'm with this all by myself, but you look at me like you just don't understand and you don't get it. And I feel very alone in that. And I said, it was sort of, you know, carrying this momentum. And I said, and if you really do believe me, why am I the only one freaking out? And at that point, the mother started to cry, you know, and she said, and I asked her about it, and she said, I just don't want her to feel alone. And the stepfather seemed visibly affected. And he said, you really gave us something to think about, you know. And then I left, you know. And then the next session I came to, the stepfather runs up to me, and he said, I never thought things would change in this house. He said, I would not have gone to counseling before you came. He said, now I'm more open to it. And he said, and can I come in and be in the session with you? So we went into the daughter's room, and he sat on the bed, and he was really exuberated. He said, I just want you to know how much I'm there for you. I want this to be the best years of your life. I want to help you drive. I want to help you do whatever you want to do. And I feel like it was that role, that father role that has been missing, and that he's really trying to step into it and really struggling, you know, like, I'm not the father. I don't really know what to do. Here's a crisis. I don't even know how to really be there. And so he just jumped into it, and it was very touching. you know. And that's one of those interventions where I felt like, you know, the universe is working through you, where it's almost like you're not doing it anymore. That feeling, that experience is coming through you, and it's so congruent and it's so strong that it's rejuvenating in a way. And I think I just want to take a minute, you know, because this is a strong story too. I just want to say, when you're working with these kind of overwhelming scenes and these hopeless scenes, and when I think about being in the world and working in regions and, you know, countries, they're devastated like that. And these were a few people. That is the kind of experience that I think helps people not then get burnt out. That background vision of feeling concept of deep democracy is one concept, but emotionally, when you're able to tap into something that deep and powerful, that it restores you, that you know why you're there, you know what you're doing, and you have hope again in something that looks like obliterating. So actually, I could probably say other things, but I feel kind of done. I feel like that might be an okay place to close and then just make space for questions. Do you want a mic, Errol?
I have it.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Errol.
Like, you mentioned a few times how, like, if I'm misquoting you, please correct me.
Yeah.
Like, some days, some interventions, like, the universe works through you, like you're right in the zone.
Yeah.
And other days, it's like not quite like that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about, like, apart from just luck and the stars lining up, what are they, like, the ingredients?
Good. That's
which
good question. Yes.
On those days, you're in the zone. Other days, it's like you're off.
Well, it's a good question. I think that's what this paper is about. I think that's what I'm trying to study in a way, is it's like, what is the numinous or the unknown or the nonlinear qualities that actually affect what you do? And I think, not to marginalize the other end, you know, is that knowing, at least in family, specifically in family therapy, it's a well-studied area. And if you know a lot of the fundamental things, you know, structuralism, you know how to work with different dynamics, different, okay, mom is allied with daughter, is allied with, you know, you look at those things, you look at how to work with that structural component of a family, you strategize, because that will help with, I think, some of the damage control at the beginning, you know. I don't even know if that's a good way to say it, but you know what I mean, like, All those things are needed. I think all those things are useful, like going into a war zone and knowing a lot about conflict resolution from different aspects, the consensus reality applications, because then you've got a toolbox full. And I think that at any level you can work then more fluidly or confidently with what you've got in your back pocket. I think then, in terms of the dream doors, that I feel like is where you do tap into something powerful, and then you work at those different levels of reality. You work at the dream figures. You work at essence levels because you have an opportunity to work on movement or to work on something sentient. And there are definitely those moments where I've had people who've said, I don't know how to say no. You know, and I can't snap. And then I said, no kidding. I said, how would you say no? And then they did it. And then they snapped. And I said, do that again for me. And, you know, you really praise it and you support it. And then they do it. And I said, now, how would you really say no if you could say it like that? And they go, I'd say no. It, you know, I mean, so, and that's not, I mean, that's just working with a body signal. It's not working with the whole field per se, but you're working then on an individual level and through that channel. But those opportunities then come. I think. So when you say what would make it quicker, or I think I'll go back to these four edges, and I was going to write them down. I don't think I did. There, Arnie writes about them, pages 65 to 68 in Quantum Minds. They're in my summary chapter of my final project, so you have to read the whole project to get to this point. But I thought this was really like a gold mine for me. There are four edges, like when you're working with a process, and one of them was getting into the process, on the edge of the process, like even being aware that there is a process, and then noticing the dynamic, I think, is it, you know, like, okay, the role in the field. So if I said, if I look at my referral, and I don't just look at the black and white things about that referral, I say, what role can I guess into it is missing? What role am I going to play? If you've had the police there for the last 6 days in a row, you're going to be the police, probably, you know, that kind of a thing. So okay, edge to the process. Edge to believing that it's meaningful. I have this a lot. When you walk in and you've got a disturbing parent, child, adolescent behavior, attitude, whatever, and I'm thinking, man, I wish that was just done. I wish that child would just stop screaming, or I wish that mother would just stop being mean, or, you know, it's the first thing I think. But if I can work with the fact that that's our gold mine, I mean, and get the courage to hold it down, it's going to help me a lot, and I think it's going to help me get there quicker. And I'm not saying you can't always do it. I mean, I've had full referrals where I've walked out and I said, geez, I don't know that I actually got to the root. I guess it's what's going to happen. You know, you're not always going to do everything or whatever. But that's the other edge, right, is edge to the – it's believing it. What's the third edge? Do you guys know? It's amazing, and I was going to bring the book. Anyway – Yeah, there's two more. So the third edge is, that's the fourth edge. Third edge, hang on, I got the third edge. The third edge is integrating it. So if it's just you yourself, you know, right, once you get to an essence level, oh, I'm a bird, or, you know, oh, here's, you know, like what was my big you song was I Believe I Can Fly. Now I have to integrate that. Edge to integration. So your family is going to be at an edge to integrating that new information, right? Oh, the dead grandmother is the one that can hold it all together. Wow, that's you. How do you hold it all together? Well, this or that or whatever. Okay, now you integrate that with yourself and your family. I don't know if you know how you apply that. The fourth edge then is using it in the world, right? So now I'm gonna not just know it in myself. I'm going to apply it in my everyday world, which is what that one family that I talked about at the beginning, the mother now was looking for a new job, and the son was at the same edge. He had to find his place in the world after graduating early, you know, and she was doing that. She was getting flyers. She was talking about what she always wanted to do with her life, you know. So that was, why am I asking? Oh, how do you get there quicker? I think for me, knowing about those edges helps me not get stuck around them and just recycle thinking, oh, I'm hopeless, but, oh, hey, hello, it's one more edge. This is expected. And the fourth edge is the interesting one because it's the one that you can't push. Any edge you probably can't push. The fourth edge, gosh, what's the key about the fourth edge? I think like other, you have to find other things in there that support that in the world, in the outside world, right? Like you're looking for a new house. You need other collaborative, whatever, synchronicities or whatever, you know. You need support from other places, too. It's not just you anymore that's doing it. So I think for me, knowing those four things helps me, if I can remember them along the way, work either at the edge and know where I am in the process, and not just get stuck there and get hopeless. Because I think for me, the key thing is courage. Sometimes I know what I need to do and I just, you know, oh, look, gotta go. See you next week. And it's really true just because I'm at my own edges too. Anyway, I don't know. That's how I would answer that question about how do you get there quicker or more frequently is knowing a little bit more about that process structure and how that might look in the application and integration. Anybody else? Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, one thing I wanted to really understand was that you said something about somebody, is he a social worker or somebody who,
yes.
Incorporated the, well, like manifested the role of mother into her work.
Oh, yes, Virginia Satir.
Okay.
She's the founder of family therapy.
Okay, and I just felt like I just missed this, something important you said about that. Can you
say
a little more about what the, yeah.
Well, back in the day, I mean, back in the early 1950s, systems theory was just developed. I mean, that goes back further. That's in 1945. And, I mean, I don't know a lot about it, but systems theory was a way of looking at systems, looking at things that functioned together. It was kind of the core basis of computer work, is how, I know, Yelena, you know much more about this, but why am I saying all that? Because family therapy really benefited from the idea of how things interacted with each other. So if I was Mikio looking at you and your family members and you were acting out or you were running away, I didn't just look at you and say, Mikio, you have a problem with running away. We have to make you stop running away. I would say, wow, look at your mom and your dad. And I wonder how they're contributing or your relationship together is helping to create somebody who wants to get out of there. Maybe they want to get out of there too or run away from something as well. Okay, why am I saying all that? Okay, so that's systems theory, family therapy. Virginia Satir, she was known among many things, but for her caretaking style, her nurturing, and her love. And that when she would work with the family, I mean, the impression I get is that she exuded, meaning she just emanated a lot of feeling, a lot of love, a lot of support, kind of an eldership role. But that at that time, at being one, the only female in this very core of the founding members of family therapy that were developing and doing very great work in developing family therapy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's one place I was like, wow.
Uh-huh.
I would have thought that family therapy was developed by women somehow. Okay.
What'd you say? Yeah, with the 50s, Mikio. They were
okay.
Taking value. We had the Stepford Wives. What?
So there are no...
It's a hot spot, Mikio. That's why you have a bubble of discussion. Ah! All the women are...
All right.
It would have been if we'd have had it out now.
Oh,
but, you know... Well,
I'm so hot.
Yeah, I'm so hot. Well, I think you're bringing up a very key point, which is it was marginalized. Feeling skills, and because she emanated this so much, it was marginalized in this thinking, in these very, you know, intense thinking communities. And it showed up in the history where she split from some of those main founding therapists, in part, I won't, you know, not only, but in part because there was a big criticism that said, you know, your love, you know, they kind of made it look superficial and yeah. Well, your feeling skills aren't going to fix. So they really underestimated the power of those feeling skills. And that's not the only thing that she contributed. But I'm looking at it particularly like now we have a word. Right, in therapy, in facilitation, meta skill, which is your feeling attitude and how you look at everyone. And deep democracy is actually embedded under even that terminology of meta skill. Meta skill is how it comes out on the outside. But beneath that is a really deep belief in the, potentially the spiritual aspect of process work, the deep belief that we are all at the, you know, at the basis, we are all connected and we are all one. And that my role is, because the field is dreaming me to be in this role, but I could quickly and easily pick up your role as well. if I can allow myself to open up to it and acknowledge it and become aware of it in myself. And that is a really a fundamental concept that I think we come from, and at least I know for me it motivates me, that what I do in the world is useful and has an effect. And that if I can do that with you, and you can do that with your loved ones, a drop, you know, that there's more maybe liberation or fluidity for you and possibility in the conflict, in conflicts, in relationship, in love, and just in relating, I guess. And then the non-local piece says, if you can do it over there, then it's having an effect somewhere else. Amazing, right? Like that's the core of it. And so that's why I wanted to say, well, Virginia Satir, maybe things, she died in 1988, but amazing that, you know, you've got a whole field of psychotherapists and world work facilitators. They're picking that up and emphasizing feeling skills with a very deep understanding of it. And so if I'm in a family and I start to feel criticized or hurt or, you know, jubilant, that it's not just a personal thing. It's actually an aspect of this field that is needed to be reflected back to them. It must be split off a little bit, or, you know, not picked up, not integrated. And that it might be non-local. It might just be, it just happened and I happen to be in the family, but it's still relevant somehow in that family, or it's really related directly to these dynamics. So yeah. That's like, to me, that's so deep about that feeling level. Like, wouldn't Virginia be like, whoa, you know, like, right. I knew it all along, you know?
Wow. Yeah, I think that's what I wanted to hear.
Well, thanks for asking. I got to say more about it. We've got time, I think, yeah. Two more questions, maybe?
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Guy.
And I also agree with the system theory of family therapy, uh-huh. as well as family constellation theory.
Uh-huh.
And when I do like a work as a family mediator or yes. divorce mediator,
yes.
I felt I have privileged to have this kind of knowledge mm-hmm. or theories, mm-hmm. especially when I co-mediate with a lawyer mediator mm-hmm. or a mediator from legal background, mm-hmm. they don't have this kind of theories. Mm-hmm. So I felt, you know, I can contribute my work. But even though the family theory is effective to intervene to the family issue, whatever, as a mediator or as a uh-huh. therapist, but I felt some limitation about family therapy intervention because these days, as you know, family is like a nuclear family. Uh-huh. And also, the case, you know, I'm Japanese, so sometimes people refer the immigrant issue to me, mm-hmm. immigrant's family.
Sure.
They just totally separated from the society, uh-huh. and their family is in their own country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they're just alone.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no family around them.
Right.
So in this case, I have to aware about their relationship with society.
Sure.
More wider family, I mean.
Yes. Right.
So
non-traditional aspects of
yeah.
family, what that means to people.
Yeah. So I was always registering, doing open forum as a public health perspective of mediation to prevent family conflict or divorce or something like that. So as a family therapist, what do you see
for
the effect from the society for the family?
I'm not sure if
how
I understand
how do
your
you
question.
Deal, how do you deal with the effect from the society to the family when you intervene to the family?
Uh-huh.
There's effect
there's
from
a lot
the society.
Of different ways. Absolutely. I mean, I think you're also asking me about the marginalization of families. I think that World Work has addressed that very well. If I come in and I'm a multiracial facilitator and I have a marginalized population of people, whether it's language, ethnicity, or race, and I missed this early on and I think I'm getting a little bit better about it, I'll say, how do you feel about having a multiracial therapist? Bring it out, put it on the table, name it, race. Race is a topic. You know, it's hot. You know, I'll say, how does it feel to have a non Spanish speaking, you know, facilitator? I'm thinking of so many different families and different things, but it's hard for me. Lots of times, what do I want to say here? I think a lot of times, if you can bring in the role, then you can, you know, you have to work with the family. You have to get them to a place where they are open to what you're doing and interventions. And I have to say, I'm a little biased. Where I found myself pushing issues that the family really didn't have, meaning like race would come up and I would want to bring it up a lot, and they weren't so into it. And I really had to follow their feedback, like, drop it. It's not coming up so much. And then there are times when I think it probably was coming up and I didn't know how to really support them as much to talk about it. And, you know, and again, edges and all that kind of thing. I think that World Work helps us deal with it, and just in terms of being aware of the role. And if you can't bring it in at the moment and identify it and even interact with it, then you work on it in yourself, is kind of where I come back to.
I agree with that.
Okay. Yeah. Time is pretty much, yeah, okay. Maybe you can ask me later. Thank you very much. Yay.